that is talking about the patriarchal period, the Middle Bronze Age of this part of the world, trying to relate the patriarchs, or to see if we can relate the patriarchs to a particular archaeological period. Actually, dates for the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, have ranged among scholars anywhere from Middle Bronze to Late Bronze to Iron Age, and some scholars are even arguing now for an exilic state, for the origin of the, or post-exilic state, for the origin of the patriarchs. Since the majority of scholars have a tendency to date the patriarchs to the Middle Bronze period, that's the time in which I thought would be most appropriate for us to deal with. One of the problems, of course, in trying to relate the archaeological data to the patriarchs is that you're dealing not with monumental structures of human towns, but with individuals. If you want to talk about Solomon, you can go out and find examples, and you sometimes find examples of Solomonic architecture. Unfortunately, the patriarchs didn't go around building large temples or large cities, and so it's very difficult to find archaeological evidence that's going to help you identify or date a particular individual. Along with talking about the rough sketch of the archaeology of this region during the Middle Bronze period, I also wanted to briefly summarize the whole of Genesis of the patriarchal stories, just to remind those of you who don't have extensive biblical background exactly who we're talking about, the types of events we're talking about. Then we'll deal with some of the extra-biblical texts, mostly from Mesopotamia, that possibly shed light on the biblical patriarchal stories. And finally, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about Canaanite religion, the nature of Canaanite religion, and what some scholars have said about the nature of patriarchal religion, because that does shed light on things that we're going to be dealing with later, the Iron Age, Israelite culture, and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff to deal with. I still haven't quite figured out how to organize this in my head, so we might be staggering along here a little bit. Okay, we mentioned in our discussion of the early Bronze Age in Jordan, Palestine, that the real urban age, the first urban age in this part of the world, is from early Bronze 2 through 3, roughly 2800 to 2300 BC. At the end of the early Bronze 3 period, 2300 to 2350 BC, you find these fortified early Bronze Age sites throughout Jordan and Palestine. Whereas the urban EB2-3 period was seemed to have been fairly prosperous in this region, as well as in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, not only do you find the destruction of urban culture in Palestine at the end of EB3, but at about the same time, you find the collapse of the empire of Akkad in Mesopotamia, and you also find the demise of the Old Kingdom in Egypt about the same time. So it's a period of violent change at the end of the early Bronze period. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of archaeological evidence in Jordan for the Middle Bronze Age. Again, you might remember when we were talking about chronology, this is a very confusing period once you enter into the early Bronze 4 period, which Kenyon calls the Intermediate Bronze 1 period. There's some confusion about the terminology at this point. But in any case, at around 2300 BC, cities are destroyed. You have a few sites that have EB4 occupation on them in Jordan, best known probably Wadi Gra and Kibbutz Iskander in the Wadi Walla. Very little has been done on Middle Bronze Age sites in Jordan. First of all, there's not that many of them, and secondly, not that many of them excavated. In 1980, the little pamphlet that Jim Sauer wrote up for the Oxford Conference states that there have been no excavations of Middle Bronze Age sites in Jordan. We do know that Tella, or Tabak al-Faha, was an important Middle Bronze site, just from the surface pottery, and I believe now that the Australians are down into Middle Bronze Age stratified levels. Is that correct, Linda? Do you know? Okay. They do have tombs, Middle Bronze Age tombs, in Pallas, so we know that there are tombs in there. But now we're just getting down into the stratified material at that site. There have also been Middle Bronze Age tombs found at Husson, this very large, one of the largest, most impressive towers up near here. But again, no concerted effort at excavating the site. Another important Middle Bronze Age site is Safut, which is located right on the edge of the Bekaa Valley. As you drive from Suela towards Jerash, as you go around the bend, you see the road which has actually cut part of the tell. One of the tragedies of that tell is it's an important, one of the few important Middle Bronze Age sites in Jordan, and they're widening the road now, so we're going to lose a lot more of the tell within the next few months. The Amman Citadel also has some evidence of Middle Bronze Age walls. At Deir Alla? You're right, please. I think you're right, no. Primarily Lake Bronze, yeah. But there is some as well. There are also a number of smaller Middle Bronze Age sites. The American group that was working just this past month at Tel Hayyan is an example of that. But again, there's been very little investigation of the Middle Bronze Age levels here. Most of the comments I'm going to make now about the Middle Bronze Age are based on the results of Kenyon's excavations at Jericho. And much of what you hear people saying about the Middle Bronze Age in Palestine is dependent upon those results, since it is one of the few sites that's been extensively excavated in the Middle Bronze Age levels. Kenyon notes that around 2300 BC, the EB walls at Jericho are destroyed. I should point out that those are the walls which, back in the 30s, were identified as the Late Bronze Age walls of Joshua. They were only about 1,000 years off. We know now that those weren't the walls that came tumbling down according to Joshua's story. Kenyon notes that at Jericho, during the Early Bronze Age period, the burial practices tended towards multiple burials, possibly family units being buried in the same chamber. That later, that is after 1900 BC, multiple burials again were practiced in the vicinity of Jericho. But in the period, the so-called Intermediate Bronze Age, or MB1, according to other people's classification, the burial practice tended towards individual burials, or one or two individuals being buried in the tomb. One of the reasons that this is important, or at least some people have said it's important, is if, again, if you think of the patriarchal story, you remember the story about Abraham going down into the region of Hebron, near Mamre, and buying a cave or a burial place for himself and for his family. From that, most scholars would say that Abraham then must date to the period after 1900 BC, since between 2300 BC and 2900 BC, individual burials are more rural. Again, it could be possible, and those who argue for an earlier date for Abraham say, well, it could be before 2300 BC, at the same type of period. Kenyon points out that the people who destroyed Jericho around 2300 BC were nomadic, non-urban type folks, or at least they didn't rebuild the city after it was destroyed. And according to her reconstruction, these were tribal nomadic groups, which she identifies as being Amorites, the biblical Amorites. And she's basing that identification on mention of the Amuru, the Mesopotamian text, but according to the Mesopotamian text, the Amuru were responsible for the great destruction towards the end of the EB3 in Mesopotamia, basically. something that I find a little difficult to buy in Kenyan is that she says these Amorites came in, destroyed city life, dominated the area for 400 years, between 2300 BC and 1900 BC. We certainly know that that first part of the Middle Bronze Age, but during that period, you do have an essentially non-urban culture. At least you don't have the big city-states as you did in the Old Bronze Age. So it seems to be more or less a, if you want to call it a nomadic or semi-nomadic, or these small farm villages, but not large cities. According to Kenyon, these Amorites, with their anti-urban bias, controlled the area during that 400-year period. At the end of that time, around 1900 BC, the former city-states of the EB period made a comeback when cities were reestablished at around 1900 BC. And with the rebirth of these cities, the Amorites were forced back into the desert. What I find difficult to go along with is that you are going to have a nomadic group coming in, dominating an area for 400 years, living and lingering around in it, not settling down and then being pushed out by the descendants of the former city-states. In any case, that's a possibility. One other very important event that occurs and that should be mentioned is the so-called Hyksos invasion, which, again, you get varying dates just to make it round, say, from about 1750 BC to 1550. Some people will put that later, 1720 or 25. Where the Hyksos, people that we don't really know who they were, they're described as Asiatics by Egyptian texts, they come through, establish themselves in Egypt, and then are expelled around 1550, which marks the end of the Middle Bronze Age, the beginning of the Late Bronze Age. And this is, the Hyksos also figure into the biblical picture, at least in the minds of some scholars, who will say that the time of the sojourn in Egypt, that is the time when Joseph and his brothers and their descendants were living in Egypt and trying to come under bondage, was probably during the Hyksos period, although that as so, that's the picture that you get. It's complicated. We don't have too much evidence to reconstruct the Middle Bronze Age, certainly not in Jordan at this point. But at least in a very simplified manner, we can say that during the Middle Bronze Age, the first part of the Middle Bronze Age is characterized by non-urban culture with the rebirth or reestablishment of cities from about 1900 on. That, again, is significant in the minds of people who are trying to date the patriarchs, that you can't find specific evidence. It's very unlikely that we're ever going to find a letter written by Abraham to his son Isaac with a date 1750 BC. We'll never get absolute dates like that. So the only way to try to date the patriarchal stories is to read them carefully, trying to notice the descriptions of the land and the relationships between the patriarchs and the other people living in the land, and then try to fit that in the period that seems to fit best. Most scholars would say then that the period that Abraham and the other patriarchs belong to seems to fit best in the Middle Bronze Age, shortly after the reestablishment of cities. In fact, a lot of the scholars that Abraham and his crew were Amorites or of Amorite stock, and we'll see some evidence of that in a bit. But they were Amorite stock, that they probably came in during this period between 2300 BC and 1900 BC with the Amorite invasion or migrations or incursions, whatever term you want to use. Certainly, the picture you get from the patriarchal stories doesn't fit the early Bronze III period when you have big, powerful city-states. It also doesn't fit in with the early part of Middle Bronze when there are hardly any cities in the area. But by the beginning of MB2, where you have the reestablishment of cities, that seems fit as well as any for the patriarchal story. Okay, just to briefly review what the book of Genesis says about patriarchal stories, starting with Genesis 12 through the rest of Genesis. Remember that according to the biblical tradition, Abraham and his father and clan take off from southern Mesopotamia at Ur. And migrate up to Haran, which is right about in here. I don't see it marked on the map, but anyway, in northern Syria, right at the edge of the Turkish border. But they stay there for a while, and in fact, although we have a tendency when you read the Old Testament to think, well, Abraham's hometown is actually Ur in southern Mesopotamia, closer reading indicates that Haran in northern Syria seems to have kind of replaced Ur as far as the center of the family. That is, you remember that when Isaac needs a wife, he goes back to the old clan, not way down in southern Mesopotamia, but up to Haran, and ends up with Rebekah. Also, when Jacob wants a wife, he goes back up to Haran, works for Laban's uncle, and ends up with Leah. So, after spending some time in Haran, then Abraham migrates on down into the land of Canaan. According to the story, it seems as if he has no trouble passing through the country. He has relatively good, peaceful relationships with the Canaanites and the other people who are in the land. He doesn't stay in Canaan very long. He goes and migrates on into Egypt. There it gets a little bit confusing. There are several stories about Abraham migrating or going down into Egypt. It's hard to tell whether he actually goes down several times or just once, and there are different versions of the story. In any case, he goes down to Egypt, comes back up, settles around the Hebron area, and dies and is buried. Okay. Got a little bit ahead of myself having Abraham died before he had any offspring. Remember his wife, Sarah, was barren. Because she was barren, she took one of her servants, Hagar, who was supposedly an Egyptian, and gives her to Abraham so that she can have children through Hagar. Through Hagar, Ishmael is born, according to the biblical tradition. And then finally, in very old age, Isaac is born to Sarah. Through Isaac, then Jacob is born. Jacob then has 12 sons. After, again, the impression you get from all of these stories is, although they're centering around the southern part, Beersheba, Hebron area, you don't have an indication that they really established themselves. They're always following their flocks, maybe grazing grains and so forth, but they don't seem to be fully sedentary. Joseph's story is probably one of the most familiar. One of Jacob's sons is sold by his other brothers into slavery, ends up in Egypt, becoming very powerful. There's a great famine. So the rest of he falls back, and finally the rest of the family joins him in Egypt. From that point on, they live very well until that Pharaoh arises and puts them all in slavery, and the stage is set.
That's essentially the story of the patriarchs.
Okay. Now, the various theories for dating the patriarchs, again, going basically from the description of the cultural milieu from the biblical text and trying to match that with the archaeological data. The Middle Bronze Age Albright is one of many that champion dating the patriarchs to the Middle Bronze Age. And dates he quotes are often 1900 BC to 1750. He puts it no later than 1750 because of the Mari text that we'll be talking about. Late Bronze is another possibility for dating these patriarchal stories. And Spicer and Gordon are the ones who put forth that theory, dating it to the 15th century, that's 1400 to 1500 BC, so right at the beginning of the Late Bronze period. The Iron Age to the time of Solomon, primarily David or Solomon, is a date that Thompson gives, and of course now that raises a question right away. And obviously in the biblical text, the patriarchs are said to be the forerunners of the Israelites. How could you date the patriarchal stories to the time of Solomon? What Thompson is saying there is not that the patriarchs themselves, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, actually lived during the time of Solomon, but that it was during the time of Solomon that these stories were collected, and that the stories themselves, according to Thompson, reflect more the culture and the scene during the Iron Age than they do the scene during the Middle Bronze Age. Certainly there are some things in there, some so-called anachronisms reflected in the patriarchal stories that certainly indicates they were written down during the Iron Age. The question is, do the traditions themselves date to an earlier period? And those are just anachronisms which were put in by the person who was committing it to writing, or were the stories, in fact, in a sense, made up at that time? If you're interested, actually, not only in Thompson's idea, but a summary of all these other views, Thompson has a book called The Historicity of the Patriarchal Narrative, in which he does come to this conclusion very late, but it's a well-documented book if you're interested. We do have it in the library. Then there are some who would date the patriarchal stories as late as the exilic period, and that is Van Cedars. So putting it in the 5th and 6th century B.C.
The first one, which is the most recent?
Which is the most recent?
Van
Cedars, I would say, probably. Although Van Cedars and Thompson have both been quite recent. And again, there are, you know, it's an ongoing debate. People are still defending Albright. In fact, I'd say Albright's still probably the most popular opinion. Not too many people go with the Late Bronze period. Maybe I should say something about the so-called anachronisms. And again, some people say that they're not anachronisms. Certainly, we know that during the Iron Age, camels were domesticated. It's very questionable that camels were domesticated as early as 2000. Although some people feel that they were. Abraham is mentioned as having camels, therefore some scholars think, well, obviously this is a guy writing the Iron Age presupposing that Abraham had camels. One more telling anachronism is a story about the digging of the well at Beersheba, in which a dispute arises between Abraham and the Philistines, some of the Philistines. Now, if Abraham is living in 1900, even 1750 B.C., there's very little chance that he had any conversation with the Philistines, since the Philistines don't arrive before 1300 B.C. And there's some other things. Abraham's referred to as a prophet. In the book of Samuel, it says very explicitly that up until the time of the Judges, people, religious people, were referred to as seers, and then after the time of Samuel, they're referred to as prophets. Well, that text is true, then it would seem that somebody in the Iron Age is talking about Abraham being a prophet, whereas if you were writing in the Middle Bronze Age, you would use that. So, Okay, we do have some archaeological evidence, as we're mentioning, a few Middle Bronze Age sites, but in fact, more light has been shed on this whole question of the historicity of the patriarchs themselves and the customs of the patriarch on Mesopotamian evidence rather than evidence here in Syria and Palestine. And I want to talk about two things there, the Mari text and the Nuzi text, which is the most important. But before I do that, I should mention one other thing, and that is that up until the 20th century, you had this very similar story to the first 11 chapters of Genesis, which were taken very literally until the 20th century. Then Gunkel suggested they were legends, and that's more or less been followed by scholars ever since. Also, beginning in the 20th century, a fellow by the name of Ulrich Alt began to study patriarchal traditions, patriarchal religions, and so forth. He was followed then by Martin Lund, and again, it's been primarily the German critical school of biblical studies, which has argued that the patriarchs, first of all, that the patriarchs were not related to one another as the biblical text indicates. The biblical text is very clear that Isaac is the son of Abraham and Jacob is the son of Isaac, and these 12, what we develop into the 12 tribes of Israel, were the son, 12 sons of Jacob and so forth. According to the, we call it the German critical school, they would say that in Palestine you had different groups, different tribal groups or even different clans, smaller divisions of tribes. You would have, an Abraham tribe, a Jacob tribe, an Isaac tribe, a Reuben tribe, and so forth. But these were individual tribes which had no blood relations between them at all. That if they did speak a common language, probably had similar religious beliefs, that it wasn't until around 1000 BC, maybe a little bit earlier under Saul, that these people were kind of thrown together by an external threat, which would have been the Canaanites and the Philistines, that external threat welded the people together in a sense, in a similar fashion to what happened in the United States, where people were very independent, but because of the threat of the British, the different states formed and then federated and cooperated with one another in order to fight the common enemy. Again, according to this reconstruction, it's only during the time of Solomon, David and Solomon, when these tribes are united and form a state of sorts, that the history of the state is written, and at that point, these different tribal groups are synthetically related to one another. Again, that kind of a theory is very hard either to prove or disprove on the basis of the archaeological evidence. We'll, in fact, never be able to do that. But we can at least, perhaps, show the setting that these stories may have taken place in. In fact, there are some people who would, a number of people, who would question the historicity of any of the patriarchs, saying either that they were, Abraham was just the name of a tribe, possibly there was an ancient character who started that tribe, but more likely that was a fictitious character. So, now going to the Mari text. Mari is a little state or city-state in Mesopotamia. It's in Syria today, right near the Iraqi border, and is known as Tel Hariri. Around 2000 BC, we know that these so-called Amenu, or possibly biblical Amorites, took over Mari and much of Mesopotamia. Their stronghold was at Mari. We don't really know where they came from. Scholars will say, well, they come from the fringe of the Syrian desert. In any case, they come into power, establish themselves at Mari, and last until around 1750. During that time, a number of cuneiform texts were written, And those texts, at least some people argue, have direct bearing on the patriarchal stories and help us date them. The primary evidence from Mari is that many of the names that occur in the biblical texts occur in the Mari texts. Abraham and or Abram and Jacob or Yaakov are attested in the Mari text. And argued Albright and a number of other scholars after 1750, those obviously Amorite names are not nearly as common as they are before that period. There is an important biblical text outside of Genesis, Deuteronomy 26, starting with verse 5, following, which is an ancient Israelite creed, which starts off, "A wandering Aramean was my father." The Arameans are descendants of the Amorites. So argue a number of biblical scholars that these Amorites are the ancestors or predecessors of the biblical patriarchs. Also, there are a number of Amorite names, other than personal names, Amorite names and words. Mentioned before, describing these people as non-urban folks who seem to be social outcasts, either people who were thrown out of their cities because they were bad citizens, or people who just didn't like to associate with cities, lived more or less like ancient gypsies. Again, there's a possibility that those Habiru are related to the biblical people, which Abraham is described obviously as a Hebrew. Again, when you read the biblical text, you hear the term Hebrew, you have a tendency to think, well, that is defining a particular ethnic or racial or religious group. According to the ancient text, it appears that anybody could be called a Hebrew. You could be a Mesopotamian, you could be a Canaanite, you could be an Egyptian, and if you were more or less semi-nomadic, living as a Robin Hood type character, robbing from the rich in order to sustain yourself, not necessarily giving to the poor, you could be described as a Hebrew. And it seems, even in the biblical text, that the way is the way in which a Hebrew is described. David is described as a Hebrew when he's running around the Judean desert trying to flee from Paul, from Saul. In other words, he's a renegade or he's running from the law. Okay, so the mention of Hebrews, not only in the Mari text, but in the Musi text, and the Amarna text, a number of different ancient sources seem to indicate that this is when these Habiru were on the scene. If the Habiru or Abiru are identical with the Hebrews in the patriarchal period, then you can think that very well. More important, actually, than the Mari text are the Musi texts. And Nuzi is also in Mesopotamia, in modern Iraq now. It's southeast of Nineveh. Well, it should be red line. Yeah, right here. The Nuzi texts date to the 14th century. And again, they mention some Amorite type names, although basically the culture of Musi was Hurrian rather than Amorite. And the importance of the Musi text is that there are a number of texts which describe the social customs of Musi in the 14th century, which again are very closely paralleled in the biblical tradition. Let's look at some biblical references. Yeah. One of the Nuzi texts tells about how a wife can be adopted by her husband after the marriage ceremony is taking place. She can be adopted or go by going to court. Her legal status can be changed from that of a wife to that of a sister. And by doing that, you elevate her legal status or increase the rights that she has. And some people have said that this may be reflected in the biblical tradition in Genesis 12, verses 10 through 20, and Genesis 20, 2 through 6, and 26, 1 through 11. And those passages are passages in which Abraham speaks of his wife Sarah as a sister. You remember, they reflect the stories of going down into Egypt when Pharaoh says how beautiful Sarah is and takes her into his harem. Abraham doesn't object, saying, you know, she's my sister. That had always traditionally been interpreted as kind of a cop-out on Abraham's part, that he was afraid to confront the Pharaoh and say, you can't have my wife, therefore he called her a sister. I'm still not convinced about this. You know, it may reflect the Nuzi tradition, but on the other hand, it seems to me that the biblical text is quite clear that Abraham was afraid in that particular situation. He was probably saying that she's my sister because he didn't want to get in trouble. It wasn't really that she did have a legal status. Also, the story of Rachel and Leah, which is in Genesis 29, verse 24 and 29, where when Leah and Rachel are married to Jacob, they are given slave girls, which are to serve them and can also act as concubines for their husband. Again, the same practice is reflected in the Nuzi text. The story of Sarah bearing Sarah with Abraham, and Sarah offering Abraham her slave girl Hagar, so that Hagar can bear children, which then will be legally Sarah's, is also reflected in the Nuzi text. This was evidently a common practice, at least among upper class women. I think one of the most interesting ones, and certainly the one text which throws most light on a biblical story that wasn't very well understood before, that is the story of Jacob's getaway from Laban after he's been working for 14 years for the hands of Rachel and Leah. That story is told in Genesis 31, verses 19 and 30. You'll remember, after working for 14 years, Jacob decides to leave. He heads on down towards Canaan. In the meantime, Laban finds out that his household gods are missing and takes off in hot pursuit. It turns out that Jacob doesn't know it, but Rachel, his wife, has swiped the household gods. And again, it's very humorous, actually, if you read the story carefully. When Laban comes in searching the tent for the household gods, Rachel sits on a camel saddle with the gods underneath her and tells her father that the way of the woman is upon her, she's having her periods and she can't get up, and she apologizes and so forth. So Laban searches the tent and goes away. Again, that has been kind of an embarrassing story for the so-called monotheistic patriarchs. You know, why would Rachel want to steal the household gods? Again, some of the Nuzi texts tell us that there was a custom when a man did not have any sons, he could pass his inheritance to the husband of his daughter. Therefore, it's possible that it would be conceivable that Laban could have adopted Jacob as his son. But in order for his inheritance actually then to pass to Jacob, in order to seal the deal, Jacob or Laban would have to hand over the household gods to Jacob. Then all of Laban's property would belong to Jacob. In other words, the household gods least at Muzi, were property titles. So what Rachel has really done is not run off with little religious cult objects.
Yeah, there is a relationship here.
But she had stolen all the old man's property. Well, again, there are a number of other examples that you could point to. And again, Thompson analyzes these. The traditional argument has been all of these social customs, which are so closely reflected in between Muzi and the patriarchal traditions, indicate that the patriarchs must have lived before the 15th century BC, when Muzi comes to an end. Thompson's argument against that is that there are parallels, but not necessarily exact parallels, and that those customs could well have existed at a much later time. So again, the arguments are not definitive, but it is at least conceivable that the patriarchal stories do reflect ancient traditions that were prevalent at Muzi. Oh boy, we're about out of time. Very quickly, run through Canaanite religion and a few comments about patriarchal religion. It's really important to understand at least the basics of Canaanite religion in order to see, first of all, what the Israelites took over from Canaanite religion. There are a number of points of contact. Certainly, if anyone of us was looking at an ancient Israelite during the worship service and an ancient Canaanite, we probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference. We know that the Israelite sacrificial system was identical with the Canaanite sacrificial system. A few little differences dealing with the pigs and baby goats and all things like that. But primarily, the sacrificial systems were the same. The religious holidays were the same. They were always centered around the agricultural festivals, the wheat harvest, the barley harvest, and the fruit harvest. On the other hand, there are certainly differences between Israelite religion and Canaanite religion, especially when it comes to cult prostitution and so forth. A few years, say 50 years ago, we knew very little about Canaanite religion, and that's where archaeology has played an important part, especially the discovery of the texts from Ugarit, Shamram, have given us a fairly good understanding of at least Canaanite religion at Ugarit. It's a little bit dangerous, perhaps, to try to extend that down to Palestine, but it seems quite probable, especially what we see reflected in the biblical text, that Canaanite religion as practiced in Ugarit was basically the same as was practiced here in Palestine and Jordan. We know from those texts that the head of the pantheon in Canaanite religion was a fellow by the name of El, known as the Father of Years, a number of different epithets. He was known as the creator of the universe, the creator of order. Usually he watched over those things which were more or less set or static, the stars in their courses, so forth, which were also responsible for social order. His wife or consort is Asherah. Which is also mentioned in the Old Testament. His son was Baal. And Baal's consort was Anah. Although El is the head of the pantheon, Baal was certainly the one who was most dynamic. He was the god of fertility, the storm god. Baal is the one that you have to please. And he worked in close connection with Anah. One other important character is Lot, which is Baal's brother. And the myths that are tied up, especially between Baal and Lot, are very important for understanding the Canaanite cult. Very quickly, certainly you've lived here long enough to realize that basically there's two seasons of the year here in Jordan. One, the summer, when it's hot, dry, and then the winter, when it's wet and cool. Whereas in the northern hemisphere, we have a tendency to identify winter with death or static existence. Here, the beginning of winter, the beginning of rains, is seen as the beginning of the renewal of things. So in ancient Canaan, the new year was not January 1st, but it was located in October when the new rains would begin. That was the beginning of the year. All of these Canaanite deities were closely identified with the forces of nature and, in fact, expressed themselves through the forces of nature. Therefore, when on a day like this, you could look out and say, Baal is very healthy. Obviously, it's raining. He must be in good health. Actually, it's not only good health, but his sex life must be very good. If you got into a very dry period, Baal was either having a very unhealthy sex life, or perhaps Baal had even died. The cycle of nature was explained according to the activities of the gods. Whereas in the Old Testament you have a tendency to say that God is in control of things, not so much as was true in Canaanite religion. The Canaanites, their view of history was totally circular, just as the agricultural cycle was circular. At the beginning of the rains, it's hard to tell, you know, when you've got a circular diagram where you actually start. Every year there was a battle, according to the myth, between Baal and his brother Mot. During that battle, Mot would swallow up, actually digest Baal. Baal obviously would die at that point, and that marked the onset of summer. When the rains stopped, searing heat began, the wheat and barley, everything which had been growing, suddenly started to dry out. And you enter in then to the harvest period. We know from the Canaanite myths, it tells then about how Anat comes to Baal's rescue. She kills Baal, or kills Mot, and the way in which she kills Mot is very interesting. It talks about her grabbing Mot, chopping him into little pieces, parching him in the oven, and then threshing him. Obviously, the killing of Mot was ritually acted out during the harvest festival. Actually, harvesting the grain would have been seen as a religious festival. In the process of threshing your grain, you're participating in the killing of Mot and the revival of Baal. The myth is really complicated. There's a lot of different facets to it, but that's basically what happened. As soon as Baal revives, he becomes sexually active again, the rains start coming down again, and everybody holds a New Year's celebration because the forces of fertility have been revived. We also have an indication, at least at Ugarit, that in the early period, El is very important. In the later period, Baal becomes much more important. Some people have used this then to also date the patriarchs back in the Middle Bronze Age. One thing that you'll notice in the Middle Bronze Age, or in the Book of Genesis, when the patriarchs are talking about the God that they worship, the word they use for God almost inevitably is El. And that was quite a shock, actually, when the Ugaritic texts were found, for people to suddenly realize that the God of the patriarchs is the same as the old Canaanite head of the pantheon. It's debatable now. El can be used at some points as just a name, a general name for God, like we use the name God in a generic sense. But it can also be used as a personal name. I have a list of references, but I won't take time to write them down, but just to mention that at Bethel, there's a god, El Bethel, who seems to be worshipped by the patriarchs. That's Genesis 31, verse 13, and also 35:7. At Beersheba, God is known as El Olam. At some place in the Negev, El has the title El Roy. In Jerusalem, El was worshipped as El Elyon, and at other sites throughout Palestine, El is referred to as El Shaddai. And you don't get these personal names coming through the English translation because they're usually translated by El Shaddai is God Almighty. But it does appear that it is, in fact, a personal name, that there was this El cult, which was prominent not only in Canaanite religion, but evidently in the early patriarchal religion. One of the reasons that I have a tendency to think that the patriarchal traditions do have an important historical kernel to them is that it's very hard to imagine at a later time, say during the Iron Age under David and Solomon, when there is a strong reaction against Canaanite religion. Now, at that point, the Israelites and the Canaanites were having it out and trying to annihilate each other. It would be hard to imagine at that point somebody would make up stories with the patriarchs, the ancestors of the Israelites, actually worshiping God by the same name as the Canaanites. Just about to finish. Two other very important passages I'd like you to look up and read carefully over the next few days is Exodus 3, verses 13 through 15, and Exodus 6, verses 2 through 3. You know, this may seem radical to say that the patriarchs were shared or were influenced by Canaanite religion, but the biblical text is actually quite clear that that was the case. There's one other passage to Joshua 24:14. And this is where Joshua gets the people together after the conquest and exhorts the people, saying, look, our fathers Abraham and Terah worshipped other gods when they were beyond the river. And Joshua is trying to get people to put away their other gods and now become Yahweh worshippers. In Exodus 3, this is the revelation to Moses of Yahweh. And when, again, most people would say that's the E tradition, during this revelation, Abraham says, who are you? How do you identify yourself? And Yahweh says, I am Yahweh, which means I am who I am. It's very complicated. It means I am who I am, meaning that, or I will become who I will become, or I am who I am in the sense that it's none of your business who I am, and that should be enough for you. It may mean that, you know, I am creative, I create what comes from being whatever. It's very complicated. In any case, Yahweh is revealed as the name at that point, and the identification is made. He says, I am the God, the same as the God of the fathers. Boy, this is complicated. You need to go up and read an article by Ulrich Alt, where he talks about the God of the fathers. Not only do you see reflected in the patriarchal tradition an El cult with Canaanite influences, but also the God of Abraham is sometimes referred to as the shield of Abraham. There is the fear of Isaac and the mighty one of Jacob, drawing on parallels with nomadic groups, especially the Nabataeans. Alt argued that there was, again, patriarchal religion was characterized by the revelation of a deity to a particular patriarch, so that originally Alt would have said that the God of Abraham was considered just that, Abraham's God, and all of the people in Abraham's clan worshiped the God of that patriarch. The God of Jacob was a different God, the God that had revealed himself to Jacob. The God of Isaac was a different one. And then again, at a later time, you have the synthesis where Yahweh is identified with the different gods of these different patriarchs. That seems to be reflected in that particular passage. In this particular passage, again, the same question is asked, who are you? And he says, in response, that he is El Shaddai. He said, formerly you knew me as El Shaddai, now you will know me as Yahweh. So again, what a lot of scholars would say here is that patriarchal religion is quite different in character to later religion. Certainly we know from the Iron Age on, when you have the Temple of Jerusalem, big ceremonies, an official royal cult, that all of the worship occurs in Jerusalem, and in fact, worship outside of the temple is considered illegitimate. And also, the name of God from that point on is Yahweh. Whereas in the earlier period, certainly Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob worshiped anywhere they wanted. Whereas in the later prophetic period, one of the worst sins you can do is worship outside of Jerusalem in some other place. And again, at those places where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob worshiped. So certainly patriarchal worship seems to be quite different than it was during the time of the united or divided kingdom. And again, that seems to me to be one other indication that you do have to push the patriarchs back. It's hard to imagine somebody writing or collecting these stories during the time of David who would talk about the religious cult being quite different in the past. More likely think that if he was writing during the Iron Age, that he would have said that the patriarchs worshipped Yahweh and were, you know, actually, in fact, that is what the law was, the one other tradition said. But I think all we can say in conclusion is that we're going to have to wait until the late Bronze Age when we start talking about the conquest and the settlement in Palestine, the beginning of the state under Saul and David and then Solomon, before you can really get concrete archaeological evidence that you can identify with biblical characters. Even then it's a little elusive, but as long as we're in the Middle Bronze Age and dealing with the patriarchs, it's really tough to get archaeological evidence that's going to allow you either to date the patriarchs or even to determine whether or not the patriarchs were historical characters. I certainly wouldn't say that archaeology has the capability of disproving the historicity of the patriarchal narratives. On the other hand, at least up until now, there's been no way to prove or demonstrate the historicity of the patriarchal narratives, and I doubt that we ever will.